Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is my third and final series on the war in Vietnam, titled, A Letter is a Living Voice. We will be reading letters and documented accounts written by Vietnam veterans. These letters show all the emotion of war, from fear to anger to love and fellowship. These are only the opinions of the writers of the documents and not those of the voice of Vashon or the readers. In addition, while some of the language in the documents may appear to be racially insensitive, it is the actual language of war. It is my opinion that to use the exact language to give the listener a true understanding of the veterans' ratings and their associated emotions is extremely important. In war, we demonize our enemy through our language and our pictures. We make them inanimate, therefore easier to kill. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our series on Vietnam. And one of the things that we're looking at is healing. And we're interviewing today Sue Warner Bean. Did I get it wrong? Did I get the last names wrong?
No. You've got the last name right.
It's, okay.
It's Warner, and I married Mr. Bean, so okay. I'm hyphenated.
Okay, well, you know, and with a name like Dr. Nurse, you know, it's, you know, I catch a lot of crap for that, too. So, I think that through these interviews that I've done, and, you know, you were asking me about this, I think the one thing that I have learned is I am 100% supportive of veterans. I am also a person that says, I don't think there's anything good about war. I don't think it's a good way of solving problems. You know, we used to say who kills the most people is the winner, and that's not necessarily true. I mean, if you think about Vietnam, there were not necessarily, we know we have pretty good statistics on the Americans killed in Vietnam, but there were over 2 million, estimated 2 million Vietnamese killed, both military and civilians. So I think we need to find better ways to, I'm not trying to get, I always said I wasn't going to get political in these things. I just think we need to find better ways to solve our problems. And I have a graduate student right now that I'm working with her on her doctorate degree, and she's from Ukraine. And just to talk to her about, she has lots of living relatives in the Ukraine, and to talk to her about just the destroying of a total infrastructure. Just makes me cry. So in this interview, we'd like to talk about Peace Tree and you going back to Vietnam with groups of veterans. So let's start out with, do they contact you? Or how do you get these groups together these are veterans that want to go back and see a variety of things? So let's start out with that.
Sure. First, I'll specify that we don't do trips that are exclusively veterans trips, with very few exceptions. I think we've had one or two where there was a specific, coordinated with a specific group to do that. But veterans are very much part of our story, and veterans serve on our board. We embrace the veteran community. We are not a political organization. I appreciate you having said that. Our role is, Peace Tree's role is to do all the work of healing land and relationships and people that you need to do after the war is over. Exactly what you spoke to. I think the way to talk about the engagement. If I may take the liberty of sharing how I became involved with Peace Trees, because I think it's one example of how these connections happen. And for me, it was trying to learn more about my brother's service. He was killed in Vietnam in 1968. He was a Marine. He was Gulf 2nd Battalion 5th Marines, and was killed in the Battle of Hue City during Tet. I didn't know any of that when I first started getting involved with Vietnam, and it came about as a result of my wanting to understand where he'd been, what he'd done, learn the circumstances of his death, learn about him. He was 15 years older than I am, and I didn't remember him very well at all. So that became kind of my personal mission, was to learn about him. In doing that and getting his military records and doing the research, it led me to the man who had been his commanding officer in Hue City. And that was, at the time, it had been Captain Chuck Meadows. He, by the time I met him, had retired as a full-bird colonel, Colonel Chuck Meadows. And at the time I met him, he was executive director of Peace Trees Vietnam on Bainbridge Island, Washington. I mean, what are the odds, right?
No kidding, yeah.
Incredible, just incredible series of coincidences. And so I met Chuck. Chuck told me about Peace Trees. He said, we take these citizen diplomacy trips, and it would be great to have you come. And I did. And I think, well, the connection there is unique. I think a lot of what happens is people learn about our work through conversations like you and I are having right now, where somebody involved with Peace Trees talks about it, shares about it, does a presentation on it, and as others learn, and it taps either their personal experience or piques their interest, they'll look and say, what does it take to go?
Yeah, I think that's good. So we probably won't see an ad for Peace Tree at the halftime of the NFL final, Super Bowl.
Probably not.
No $3 million for 10-second commercial.
Right.
It would be nice if you had as much money as Fritos and Pepsi, but...
that would be great. And yeah, you'd do some great work with
that's
it.
That's right. So go ahead what did you find out about your brother? Did you what were the things? Were there some things that you found out that you were not aware of?
I was aware of so little when I started that it was all discovery for me. Where do I start? Right?
Do you have letters from him?
And I was just going to say, I think the place to start is letters. As you said in the opening, a letter is a living voice. And so, on a lighthearted note, I'd been hoping to learn what he thought of his little sister, right? I didn't have any letters from him.
Sure.
So I ended up, through some of his friends, finding some of the letters that he'd sent to them. And I was so excited because one of his friends said, look, you're actually mentioned in this letter, Sue. And I thought, well, wonderful. Finally, I'm going to have my brother, saying he's so proud of his little sister. And I get the letter, Steve, and I read it. And about halfway through, it says, when Susie was born, I was really disappointed. I hoped she would be a boy. It's like, wow, I waited how many years to hear that?
To hear something positive, yeah. And,
oh, dear, but it made me laugh and laugh. But, what I've learned is about him, he was funny, he was smart, he was athletic, he was an Eagle Scout, he was a photographer, he was an avid reader, he loved, so I've learned personally about him. But what I loved learning from the people who served with him is that he was somebody who was truly a leader. He always was upbeat. He always was a listener. I loved hearing that. He would never ask them to do something he wouldn't do himself. He would ask them instead of tell them. He inspired them. He kept them safe. They trusted him. They respected him. They loved him. And what an incredible gift to get to learn that by meeting those who served with him, who stood alongside him, and then also to read these letters home that he sent. And where it really, what was really extraordinary for me was coming home from my first trip to Vietnam with his commanding officer, with Colonel Chuck Meadows, on this Peace Trees trip, and talking with my mom about it. And she brought out the box of personal belongings that she had had stored away. And we opened that. She gave it to me to open. I opened it, and in there were old colored slides, including some that were pictures of him that I'd never seen, and things that he'd sent back from Vietnam, and then also reel-to-reel tapes. And he didn't just, I mean, he literally, it was literally a voice. A letter is a voice. And he was talking about being there. I had them all digitized. I had them put on CD. I shared them with family. But what an incredible thing after 40 years to hear my brother talking about being in those same places that I had just visited. It was profound. It really was.
Yeah.
And, along with many other things, I was touched by his speaking about the beauty of the place. And that's been my experience, too, just the landscape. And he talked about how at night, when the light hit the hills around him just right, it looked like snow in the Cascades at home. It was very poignant. It was very beautiful.
I think that's something that's been pretty consistent with almost everyone that I've interviewed, is they've talked about, how busy the place was and how beautiful it was, that, to have a war in a place this beautiful is just almost oxymoron, and so you heard these, you actually heard these tapes. Wow. And probably very personal and everything, and those that's kind of what we're, what we're trying to get through in this series, is that, these were average people. Sure, they were warriors. Sure, they were out there in the infantry, but they were people from all walks of life. I've talked to people who were 17 and wanted to go there and wanted to get right in the battle and to get right there. And I've also talked to other people that were just scared to death to be there. I mean, it's the whole 360 degrees of emotion, and no one really knew what they were getting into. So let's talk a little bit about the folks that you've gone with on some of these trips, and what has been their experience, and what have they been thinking about going back?
The folks I've been back with, there's one who stands out in particular, and I'm going to share him as kind of an exemplar of what I've seen on other trips. This was, the string of coincidences involved in this whole story for me personally just sometimes makes my head spin. I ended up getting connected with the Marine who replaced my brother after my brother was killed. So they were down. This guy got sent out. He's fairly new in country. And he got sent into my brother's squad. So ended up meeting this extraordinary man. His name is Jim Lewis. Sadly, he's no longer with us. But Jim found out about Peace Trees. Again, personal connection, shared my involvement. He learned about Colonel Mendel's involvement and decided he was interested in Peace Trees, too, and decided to go on a trip. He actually decided to sponsor a project and go over for the dedication of this project. And landing in, I had the privilege of traveling with him on this trip as part of a citizen diplomacy group with Peace Trees. And we started our trip in Hanoi, and the tension in this 6'2" body was, you could feel it a yard away, and understandably, to return the first time and have your first place be Hanoi had to be incredibly overwhelming. And so he was kind of on guard, tense, taking it in. I think trying to feel a sense of safety. You know, how could you, right? We finished our time in Hanoi. We went down to Quang Tri Province in central Vietnam. We started visiting Peace Trees projects, and there was this catalyst moment. And I think I mentioned Peace Trees has now 24 kindergartens that have mostly been sponsored by individual donors, individual people. So we went to one of these kindergartens, and it's a kindergarten that's used to having visitors come from Peace Trees, citizen diplomats come. And the little kids swarmed Jim, and they came around him, and they laughed, and they hugged him. And he knelt down with them, and you could just see the fear starting to melt away. You could see him relaxing. You could see him laughing with these kids. So that was the first catalyst moment. But the second one that is very vivid in my memory was when we went to the dedication of the kindergarten that he sponsored for his dear friend who had been killed and died in his arms in 1968 in July. So Jim had sponsored this school. We went there, and he lifted the cloth off the plaque that dedicated this kindergarten to his friend Jesse Griego. And he looked at it, and he looked at the children and the community around, and his eyes welled up, and he said to me, for the first time in 41 years, it's okay to be alive.
Wow. That's, you know, and I can hear in your voice the emotion and looking at this, and, you know, you are there. You can see those vivid images, but you really make them come alive for this audience. And wow, I'm just that's amazing. It is, and so this is an example of just really one person. And you said you've taken many of these trips.
I've been on six. I'm taking my seventh in May.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And how many people are going?
I think we have 13 on this trip.
Uh-huh.
12 or 13.
Yeah.
Smaller group, yeah. So, again, a group that sponsored a kindergarten. It's a group of my colleagues who, I'm an instructor in the Aviation Safety and Security Program at USC in California. And our program director and a group of instructors decided to sponsor a kindergarten. Amazing.
Wow.
So we're going over to dedicate it. And we have one Marine veteran in the group, Vietnam veteran, and then two other individuals who are veterans, but were not to Vietnam. So it's mm-hmm. going to be quite an experience and mm-hmm. real privilege to travel with veterans to Vietnam, especially those who have served there. And, Jim's story is, as I said, it's an example of what I've seen happen when veterans choose to do that and to go back, and inevitably surprised by the warmth with which they're received, the hospitality and graciousness of the Vietnamese people, the beauty of the place. It's a lot's changed in four decades.
Yeah, and the folks that I've talked to have, my friend here, Mike Dorsey, who is in the studio today, mentioned that, when he was back there, he was treated with courtesy, and people were glad to see him. And we think that part of it is that, Vietnam has been in war forever. It was almost it was kind of the daily way of life for most Vietnamese in the, 40s, 50s, and 60s. I mean, there was always war going on. So it's just something that you dealt with. And
I think that, and it's gone on for centuries. And And also, what, more, I think 90% or more of the population at this point was born after the war.
Right. And, you know, wasn't World War II the war to end all wars? And
don't we wish.
We haven't figured that one out yet. When these groups go, they get together with the local people, they get together with the kids,
In fact, a typical trip and the one I was just on, we started in Hanoi, we often do, and sometimes have the opportunity to go to the embassy, to get briefed by the U.S. embassy on what our priorities and activities are over there. In our case, we had the chance to meet the new ambassador. He was delightful and has taken a real interest in peace trees. We met with the families of North Vietnamese soldiers who are still missing in action since the war. There are more than 200,000 North Vietnamese still missing in action.
I did not know that. Wow.
And who knows how many South Vietnamese.
Right.
So we also met with the POW MIA Recovery Agency for the U.S. missing in action. There are still about 1,400 missing in action. So we met with them and learned about their work. So we begin just getting educated on what's going on in the country, what are the issues, what are the war legacy issues that are being addressed, and also, as always, cultivating relationships, because isn't that the thing that makes all the difference? That's peacemaking at its grassroots level, is relationship. And from there to Central Vietnam, where we get to see Peace Trees projects, meet the demining teams, visit the kindergartens, learn about economic development, see the Mine Risk Education Center, meet with landmine accident survivors, and then typically take another couple of stops along the way, maybe Hue City, down to Saigon.
And when you get there, do you spend a week there or 2 weeks? Or
typically 2 week trips.
Okay. And mm-hmm. people from all over the United States. And how do they find out about you? How do they find out that these trips are available?
It really does seem to be, in most cases, people sharing stories with friends, right? And so somebody comes back from a trip or gets involved with Peace Trees, they tell their friends, they tell a friend. It's very organic. Now, the Seattle Times has done some great articles. Costco did a feature in their monthly magazine because one of our projects involves economic development projects involves working with pepper farmers, black pepper farmers, and the product is sold at Costco. So there are those sorts of things. It does get some publicity. We do get some publicity, but a lot of it is word of mouth. And people go, and you have a transformative experience like that, and you want to tell people about it, right? Because relationship is very important in the work that we do, I think it's very natural that relationship helps draw people to the work that we do.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure at Costco you can get a two-pack of metal detectors in a shrink-wrapped thing, and for a very reasonable price.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do try the black pepper, the Costco brand. It's excellent, and it's from Quang Tri Province.
Yes, I've worked with some, when I was in Costa Rica, I've been working with a principal that I found on, they were having their Christmas, their spring break in our Christmas time when we were there, and I met the principal, and I've been working with that little little school that you take a four-wheel drive up to that's right by the volcano. It's been interesting to see how appreciative they are. We got there were 12 kids in the school, and I got them all uniforms one year, and then I got him a computer the next year and hooked up to Wi-Fi. And then the last time I was there, we met with him at a resort in Costa Rica. And all the kids came down. All the kids came down. And, you know, they were all dressed up. And the resort gave them, you know, gave us a room and kind of had little special pastries and stuff for them. And I remember this one little girl who said, the lady asked her, which one would you like? She said, I would like one of all of them. And, you know, so, and it was, I think maybe we need to look through, look at these things through children's eyes. You know, in all the pictures, too, that I've seen that have been taken in Vietnam, I really, you know, you see all the human emotion. You see everything from fear to laughter. But the one thing that strikes me with almost all the pictures that I've seen is that when people have their picture taken, for the most part, they're smiling. They're thinking positive things. And maybe that's the way we need to look at it. We need to look at this a little more through children's eyes. And, you know, they're, you know, children have to learn prejudices. Children have to learn, boy, I'm getting on my soapbox now. but children have to learn to hate. You know,
that's right.
You don't have to learn to love. You have to learn to hate. And I think that's an important thing. And if you put two kids together, they don't care what the other kid looks like as long as they want to play. And that's maybe a good way to kind of end up this this interview. And Sue, I hope I can get a chance to meet with you in person, maybe with Dave sometime or something, and talk about these things. I realize I'm 74 now, but I figure if I always have projects going, I'll never die, you know. So, you know, one of my favorite epitaphs is from Charles de Gaulle, and his epitaph says, the graveyard is full of indispensable people. So, you know, I appreciate that. You know, there will, and I just hope that there's somebody to take all the footsteps of everybody out there. So with that, I'm going to let it go. And then I'm going to, I'd like to, I'll give you a call later this week if we could talk again, and we'll see what the next project brings and how we can bring some positive things to some more people. How does that sound?
Wonderful. Hey, it would be wonderful. May I leave you with two brief quotes, Steve?
Sure, sure.
Because it speaks directly to something you said a minute ago. We dedicated a kindergarten to my brother in Vietnam, and on the wall, the plaque says, if we're to have real peace, we must begin with the children. And that's a quote from Gandhi. And I think it is so true. We need to teach peace. And the other thing that I'll share is a quote by Richard Rohr that says, pain that's not transformed is transmitted.
Yeah.
And we need to continuously do the work of transforming pain.
Absolutely.
Through relationship, through having the courage to face the hard things.
And just talking.
And transform them. And
just
talking. And listen.
Whether it's countries, whether it's countries or whether it's my wife and I, we need to talk more.
Talk more and listen more.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. Actually, there you go. Listen more. That's what my wife would say. Don't solve the problem. Just listen to me. So thank you, Sue.
And we'll be,
take care and have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Oh, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Boatman. Wait, hey, 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 Mr. Boatman. Oh, yeah. Please, please, Mr. Boatman. Oh, yeah.
You've been listening listening to Is Abled with Dr. Stephen Nurse. This has been part three of his series on the war in Vietnam entitled A Letter is a Living Voice. To hear additional episodes, including his previous series on the Vietnam War, go to voiceofashon.org and look for Is Abled under the Shows tab.